This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. Okay, really, it's 5:10. We never start anything on time here, but you get the picture. My name's Kat Johnson, and I'm here with my co-host, Katie Mosman-Wadler.
Hi, guys.
She is the executive director of HRN. If you didn't know, now you know. Patrick is not here today. We miss him, and hopefully we'll see him next week, our perennial co-host, Patrick. We have special guests today. We have Paul LeBeau here from Wolfgang Mock, and they make home milling equipment. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks.
And then we have Rob Elliott and Nate Littlewood from Urban Leaf, and they are trying to bring home gardening to all of us. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks.
All right. So, and we also are going to have a very interesting call with Beth Shapiro. She's the executive director of City Meals, and we're going to talk a little bit about SNAP budget cuts and some important stuff to all of us. So, first, we're going to kick off the show with rapid-fire headlines from the past week, and then Katie and I are going to recap our trip this weekend to Charlotte, North Carolina. We talked to a lot of awesome chefs while we were down there, and we also attended the International Symposium on Bread, which is where we met Paul.
Excellent. Well, should we kick it off with the HRN headlines?
Let's do it.
All right, let's do the thing. So what's better than breakfast, guys? On Eat Your Words, host Kathy Irway talked to Rachel Kong from Lucky Peach Mag about the most important meal of the day and its star ingredient, eggs. Rachel and the editors of Lucky Peach have laid it all out in their new All About Eggs cookbook, which is a veritable egg encyclopedia of recipes and preparations for this incredible edible food item.
And we all know that you can't have eggs without bacon, so to celebrate the 300th episode of Cutting the Curd, host Diane changed things up a bit and talked about meat with fellow HRN host Katie Kiefer. Katie's new book, What's the Matter with Meat, is filled with valuable information about the meat industry and its impact on the environment.
And check out Katie's show this week on What Doesn't Kill You. She talked to Andrew F. Smith, who is the author of the new 3-volume book, Food in America. He talked about the set, which is focusing on food controversies related to the environment, nutrition and health, and the economy. I think that covers like a quarter of the food controversies, maybe?
Yeah.
A lot of those.
It's not what we typically think of as American food, but Snacky Tunes bugged out this week when they were joined by Josh Evans. He is a former member of the Nordic Food Lab, which is the group behind the compelling and eye-opening new book on eating insects.
Which is our engineer David's favorite thing to do.
Yum!
Bugs also got a mention on Foment About It. Jay Goodwin, who's the co-founder and director of Blending and Brewing at the Rare Barrel and also the co-host of the Sour Hour podcast, called in to talk about barrel-aged sour beers, bugs, off flavors, and hot sauce. So if you're like into any of those things, tune in to Foment About It this week.
On A Taste of the Past, Linda focused on the sweet nectar of flowers. Roses are indigenous to Iran, and distilling the essential oils of the flower to make rose water has been practiced there for over 2,500 years. She talked to cookbook author Yasmin Khan about the significance of the seasonal specialty.
And it was tea time on Radio Cherry Bomb this week. Carrie sat down with Linda Apolipsius. She's the co-founder of Tea Tulia, which is a progressive tea company based around a community-forward organic tea garden in Bangladesh. They talked about sustainability, taking care of their employees and the communities, and how to brew the perfect cup of tea.
And speaking of tea, Akiko Katsuyama talked about tea on Japan Eats as well. She spoke to Tomoko Honda of Ippodo Tea in Midtown Manhattan.
Now I'm getting really thirsty and I have this glass of rosé left over from food talk. Thanks, Mike, that I'm hoping to get to. So we are going to take a little look at In the Drink, where Joe Campanelli was joined in the studio by sommelier Michael Skernick. Michael, in 1987, founded Skernick Wines to represent a few boutique wines from California, and his business has just exploded, so he's super well-known now. Check out that episode to learn more than you can handle about wine. Joe was talking about having to have him back for part two of that episode.
Wow. So speaking of booze experts, Damon and Souther talked to marketing specialist and certified sommelier Adrian Stillman. She is the author of Where Bartenders Drink, which is a comprehensive guide of 700-plus bar recommendations from 300 expert bartenders in 60 countries.
And in case you're in the mood for some historically inspired distilling, listen to Feast Your Ears to learn about Jim Costanzo from the Aaron Burr Society. They started distilling whiskey in 2010 with the Second Whiskey Rebellion as a radical act of civil disobedience. Do you want me to hit these next? We have a lot of beverage-themed ones in a row.
We do.
So also check out...
I'm getting tipsy.
I know. For more wine, listen to The Grape Nation for another sommelier and wine executive, Michael Madrigal. Really, really well-known guy talking about what to drink all summer long. Whites, reds, rosés, sparkling. And then... Oh, I have another wine one, but it's...
It's National Wine Day, too, by the way.
Oh, that's why we're having all these wine shows.
Yeah.
Okay. Kat, take it away with Dana's show.
Oh, Dana. So she chatted with Jordan Gasper on Speaking Broadly. She's the managing partner of... Is that a Cell Foods? Am I saying that?
Excel Foods, Excel like Accelerator. Foods.
Yep. Yeah. It invests in innovative and disruptive food and beverage companies, and she describes how she chooses between the thousands of products to find the winners and about the challenges of traveling, balancing travel, work, and young kids, which sounds really challenging. as challenging as trying
sounds
to
terrible.
Say this sentence. And then Army vet turned entrepreneur Kim Jung explains the mission behind Rumi Spice, a company which works with women farmers in Afghanistan, bringing peace through saffron.
And keeping up the girl power, Erin on the Farm Report this week talked to Gabrielle Ludwig. She's the director of sustainability and environmental affairs for the Almond Board of California. And then on Feast Meets West, Linda and Iris, sorry, I should get that right. That's actually my middle name also, so you should really think I'd be able to pronounce it. They're talking to executive chef Paul Donnelly of Chinese Tuxedo and also their co-owner, Eddie Buckingham. And they talked about the challenges that they faced when they were opening their opera house turned Chinese restaurant in Doyer Street in Chinatown in New York City. And talking about the history of Chinese food in Australia, where Eddie was raised, and how it differs to the American Chinese cuisine, so might be of interest to some of our guests today.
Yeah. And finally, on Food Without Borders, Sari talked to self-taught Indian chef Gaurav Anand. Anand talks about how he learned to cook by observing India's master chefs, including leading restaurateur Jigs Kalra, his clientele list for his catering company and restaurant that includes business leaders, politicians, and celebrities. And that wraps up all of our HRN headlines.
That was intense.
That was
cheers,
a lot.
Kat. That was,
cheers.
How did we do all that?
I don't know.
Cheers.
Thank you to Hannah and Hallie for writing up all those headlines.
I'm exhausted.
I know.
Cheers. It's been a big week here at Heritage.
A lot happens.
And somehow a lot of that happened in our absence. Things just kind of ran themselves because we've been gone since Friday.
They didn't run themselves. I ran them.
Uh-huh.
That's
thanks, David.
True.
Yep.
David held down the fort.
David ran the entire show since we were not here. Thank you. Yes. Bravo. Bravo.
Oh, wow. What a great audience.
I know. Our audience is the best. We have the best show. So we were in Charlotte, as Kat mentioned. We did a round of interviews with chefs, and I would like to say I've never eaten so much food in my life, but that would be a lie. But I ate a lot of food. We had about like six pretty significant kind of chef's tasting menus in like 2.5 days. We were on a trip that was celebrating Springer Mountain Farms chicken. They do all humanely raised, antibiotic-free chickens, mostly like in the distribution is mostly in the Southeast. They're really cool about supporting chefs. And so
we really got to go down and meet a bunch of the chefs that are working with them and get a little bit of a sense of what Charlotte has to offer. Although I think the highlight for Kat might not have been one of the meals, but one of the drinking sessions.
It was great. We went to the Punch Room in Charlotte. And if you are ever in Charlotte, you must go there. It's on the 15th floor of the Ritz-Carlton, downtown Charlotte. And Bob Peters, who is the bar program manager there, he has like a very fancy title that I'm not remembering right now. But he just makes the most incredible, like, Willy Wonka-esque drinks, and it was just great.
Yeah, you should definitely listen to our interview with him on the HRN On Tour show. We talk a lot about his kind of strategy behind building a drink, and also he's obsessed with finding the perfect glassware. So he has these really unusual vessels that the drinks are served in, and we also got to go up to the roof of the Ritz-Carlton where he's built a kind of rooftop garden up there with two beehives and kiwi plants and tons of herbs that the chefs and the bartenders are using. It's really wild. So that was cool. And then we actually went to one restaurant twice because we liked it so much. We went to Yafo Kitchen twice, which is kind of a fast casual Mediterranean restaurant that we ate way too much food at. And then for basically all day Monday and Tuesday, we ate lots of bread and learned everything there is to know about bread. The whole event was put on by Peter Reinhardt and Johnson & Wales University, and it attracted an international crowd. They sold out. I think there were 200 spaces available, and they sold out a couple months ago. And
I love
And there's
bread.
Oprah. We can't do a show without Oprah these days.
You just see David like cracking up.
He's been waiting for his moment.
I don't know how that happened. I didn't do that.
I know. You must have just hit the button. Have you played that in every show or just ours?
Well, bread.
Bread. So we will be posting all of the recordings from the Bread Conference to the HRN On Tour page as well. So if you want to tune in, take a listen there. I really recommend it. In particular, we were super excited to hear from Francisco Migoya from Modernist Bread because we are going to be producing a podcast with them. It's going to be a really beautifully edited special that's going to come out in the fall to coincide with the release of the 6 volumes of Modernist Bread. They were very, very pleased to announce that the final version of Modernist Bread is actually, I think it was 20 pages longer than Modernist Cuisine.
Wow.
So they really have a lot to say on bread, and the photography that we saw is just incredible. So stay tuned for that. And with that, I think I'd like to get into saying hello to our first guest, who's going to be Beth Shapiro, the executive director of City Meals. Beth, are you on the line?
I am. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining us today. I want to give a very quick introduction to City Meals. It's a nonprofit organization that delivers meals to elderly New Yorkers to ensure that they never go a day without a nutritious meal and a warm visit. They use a network of compassionate volunteers. So, Beth, did I capture the essence of what you're doing, or would you like to add anything about City Meals?
I'll add just a tidbit in recognizing the people that we serve are homebound elderly New Yorkers, so people 60 and older who really can't get out and shop or cook for themselves anymore, but the people who help build the city for us.
Wow. And we heard about you through the op-ed that we saw today. We wanted to talk to you in particular about how President Trump's proposed budget cuts are going to affect City Meals and New Yorkers in general.
The proposed budget cuts actually get rid of an entire safety net of social services for New Yorkers. For the people that we serve, homebound elderly, funding for Meals on Wheels programs in New York City and all across the country rely on the Older Americans Act nutrition program. It's very simple, 67 cents for every meal delivered across the country gets reimbursed by the federal government. The decrease of $3 million from the current level can have devastating effects for us and others, and you're looking at a program that is proven beneficial to keep older people in their homes where they want to be, in the comfort and familiar setting of their communities for a cost that's pretty insignificant.
And is there an association between the Meals on Wheels, the program, and City Meals? Can you explain that?
Sure. So in New York City, Meals on Wheels is funded by the city government Monday through Friday, the preparation and delivery of meals Monday through Friday. City Meals was founded 35 years ago by restaurant critic Gail Green and chef James Beard, specifically to fill the gap, the recognition that these older people, like you and I, really want to eat every day, not just 5 days a week when the government's open.
Mm-hmm.
So we fund weekend, holiday, and emergency meals to the same people who need meals during the week. Our portion of that is now over about 2.2 million meals annually to the same 18,000 New Yorkers.
Wow.
Yes. It's a large group. We're feeding over 200 people that are 100 years old or older.
Wow, that's amazing.
And Beth, what can all of us do to help support your organization?
Multiple things, and it's not hard. Most important, go online, citymeals.org, make a donation, sign up to volunteer. You mentioned our volunteers in your first statement. Last year, we relied on over 15,000 volunteers who helped with 72,000 hours of time. So for us, it enables us to do all that we do. And the other step is to get on the phone and write letters and call your representatives. They cannot let this budget pass.
What are some resources that you can recommend for kind of a general audience to understand the proposed budget cuts and the SNAP program in general?
So SNAP is different funding through the Older Americans Act, but the SNAP budget cut 25%, about $193 billion to be cut over the next 10 years, impacts households with children, elderly adults, and older people with disabilities. Nearly 5 million of adults over the age of 60 rely on SNAP. I think the best resources are, you know, to look online. We have Resource Center on our website, but it's very specific to elderly.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, you can Google and get information about SNAP and other hunger-related resources that are very, easy to follow. They're not difficult to understand. And to look at, you know, in New York, 1 in 10 city seniors are facing hunger each year. We're a city of home to 1.4 million people over the age of 60. That is increasing in the city and across the country. In the city, older people are the fastest growing population and will outnumber children for the first time in history by the year 2030. And it's imperative that we take steps and that everyday New Yorkers take the steps to understand what will impact them. And quite frankly, in the long run, all of our tax dollars. It's much cheaper to keep people in their homes with meals delivered than it is to be hospitalized or a nursing home. A year of meals home delivered is a day in the hospital.
Wow. Well, thank you, Beth. That really puts it in perspective, and I really encourage all of our listeners to check out City Meals, try to donate, try to volunteer, and make sure you're doing everything you can to understand what's going on with the proposed budget and to take action in your district and state. Beth, thank you so much for being on our show today, and I hope to hear more from you soon.
Kat and Katie, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Beth.
So we are going to take a very quick break to have a word from our sponsors. And when we get back, I'm really excited to jump in and talk about mock mills and about the world's tiniest garden. We'll be back in a moment.
Yeah. Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Thanks, Brandon. I love that Brandon is a very, very, very big sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
And I totally agree that Roberta's is super, super, super awesome.
This is Brandon Hoy.
It's true. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Brandon.
This is Brandon Hoy.
What's up, Brandon?
This is Brandon Hoy.
Okay. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you.
Jeez, he just will not stop.
I'm very, very excited to talk to Paul, Nate, and Rob right now because what's cool about both Mock Mill and Urban Leaf is that it's like trying to enable the home cook. So let's jump right into it. Should we start with Paul? And Paul, tell us a little bit about what is the Mock Mill?
Oh, gee. The Mock Mill's great. We have a great name for it. Everybody says Mock Mill, but what's that? Well, Wolfgang Mock is my partner and is incredibly well known even around the world in the food conscious environment as the mill man, the man who made stone mills. And in fact, he really did in the late 70s, early 80s, figure out how to make an efficient, beautiful mill that works really well for making your own flour out of any kind of grains, pulses, or even spices. And his mills are still the most widely respected. So Mock Mill is the latest stone mills created by Wolfgang Mock, very simply.
And they're pretty small. The recent one that has come out basically attaches to a KitchenAid?
Yeah, actually, this is the one that's been out for a while. It attaches to a KitchenAid. And it is, hang on, let me grab it. I love actually to hold it because it's really a beautiful little piece of equipment. I have this thing called my Forrest Gump Act where I get to take it apart and show people how it works. And it just, in just a couple of seconds and a couple of actions, it just comes apart like Tom Hanks' rifle in the movie. And all of a sudden you're looking at this really beautiful little stone mill that's taking the grain in from the top from the hopper that you stick in there, and it has to make its way through down onto a chute that falls into the bowl of the KitchenAid. And it gets crushed into really beautiful flour in so doing.
Wow.
And so it's a really beautiful little piece of kit, as our Australian friends might say.
It's
caught the imagination and the admiration of really the whole bread baking world. The top chefs have them all at home and bake make flour to bake for their families with it.
Go ahead, Katie.
This was one of the questions that came up during the bread symposium of somebody asked exactly when they should be milling the flour to bake the bread, and I believe Wolfgang answered that question, but do you remember what his answer was?
Well, his answer is right away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and basically the reason is because a kernel of cereal is like a treasure chest, a nutritional treasure chest. It's just got so much wonderful stuff and it's beautifully balanced. And the moment you break it open, the moment you open that treasure chest, it's all that value is headed downhill. Slowly, but it's headed downhill. And so the best thing to do is to use it right when you open it up.
Awesome.
And you can only do that yourself at home. Nobody can do it for you.
Mm-hmm. It's really rethinking the way that we go about baking bread, dramatically changing what the first step of that process is. But I think it's going to be one of these try it for yourself and see the amazing difference kind of stories.
Yeah. Now I want to turn to Nate and Rob from Urban Leaf. Guys, can you just tell us what Urban Leaf is?
Sure. We're a business that aims to make growing food at home fun, easy, and accessible. Basically, we just want to show people that this is not something that's intimidating. There's a lot of benefits to it, and you know, we should do a whole lot more of it, basically.
And you just opened your Kickstarter on Monday, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Tell us about the Kickstarter itself, and then what the actual process of growing a plant in the Urban Leaf is.
Absolutely. So the product that we have on Kickstarter at the moment is called the World's Smallest Garden. It's a little device that turns a bottle into a self-watering hydroponic garden. So it's about 5 inches long, just slips down into the neck of the bottle, and it comes with all the seeds and the nutrients and the hydroponic substrate and everything that you need to get, you know, just culinary herbs and small vegetables to, sorry, herbs and, and small vegetables to grow. So it's really designed and intended as a gateway product, something to welcome people into this field for the first time. Mm-hmm. Selling for $12 for a 3-pack at the moment, so it's pretty affordable as well.
And technically, is that considered a hydroponic garden?
Yes, I'll jump in. So this is Rob. I'm the plant scientist, I guess an engineer behind it. So yeah, it is a hydroponic garden technically. I guess if we want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, for the first part of its life, it's a wicking soil-based garden because the 5-inch long substrate will draw water up and keep it at a good moisture air ratio. But then once the plant is larger, the roots will reach directly down into the water. And this method's called the Kratky hydroponic method, where the roots kind of chase the water as the level goes down. And what that does is it allows the top part to be available to air, because roots, just like us, take sugar, break them down by cell respiration, so they need oxygen as well as water to grow.
Very cool. What types of plants can people grow with Urban Leaf right now?
So the good news is we haven't found many plants that don't grow in it. Basil was like the big one we wanted to get all of our beta testers using, so we've had about 300 people now grow a basil plant. Mint works really well. I have some tomatoes, snap peas. Bok choy did incredibly, oddly enough. So it's a pretty flexible system, I would say. But obviously, most of like the big plants we're doing are dwarf varieties, just because you're in the neck of a bottle.
Yeah. Do you have to prop the bottle up for a plant like a tomato?
So we're using, they're called Tiny Tom tomatoes, and it gets about 8 inches high. So, no, you don't need to prop it up. It stays vertical on its own.
That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah. I'm sorry we didn't bring a sample with us, but did you guys see the photos?
Oh, yeah, we watched your video.
And we'll put some of these on our episode page, too, so people can see it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you describe it, though, for our listeners? What does it look like?
It looks like a little garden oasis. It's just beautiful. It's luscious and green.
The poet.
It looks like someone who really likes wine drank all the wine and then was like, I'm going to grow a garden in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's, once you do something, you start to see it everywhere. So for me now, I just see like people that put flowers and plant stems in a wine bottle. So if you didn't know what was going on, you might just think that it was a cup plant in a bottle. The device kind of disappears.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think it's really interesting between Mock Mill and the world's tiniest garden the world's smallest garden, right? Correct me. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I'm telling everybody the right thing to Google. But both of you, you guys from Urban Leaf are in the very early stages where you're still assembling prototypes in your own home. But that was also the case for the early Mock Mills, was it not? Can you tell us about when did the first kind of Mock Mill production begin and what that looked like?
Oh, gosh. That was back in the 70s, in the late 70s. Wolfgang had been studying psychology and had just actually started baking bread and had discovered the wonder of freshly milled flour. And he had an old hand crank mill and he got tired of that. And he wanted an electric mill, bought an electric mill, and said, this thing's kind of not what I want. It blows flour around. I don't like that. I could do better. And started working on building his own mill. And he finally got a design he liked. He built the mill, and his friend said, oh, I'd like one of those. And so he built another one, and then more people wanted them. And all of a sudden, he looked at it, he said, this is a lot of work. Our whole apartment's full of mill parts, you know. And he just decided that he was more motivated to go out and try to spread the word on fresh milling with really cool mills than to keep working specifically on autistic kids. And off he went. So, yeah, they built meals in their apartment for quite some time.
It sounds like the precursor to Kickstarter, but following a really similar model, actually, of that startup. Do you have any advice to offer to Urban Leaf for growing a startup? A food device, would we call it?
Yeah, well, what I'd say in general, and I've actually been a startup guy all my life, and I was like the first man in Europe for a company that wasn't sure to make it at that time, and today it's worth $13 billion on the stock exchange. So I've been part of some really incredible startups, and I would just say if you believe in it and if it's unique and if you're not going up against some, overly formidable competition, then just go for it and stake your claim on the territory and make sure that everybody knows it's yours, and then go, because it's both companies are talking about bringing people closer to their food.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fantastic thing, and I think that's what the newer generations want. They want to be close to life.
Yeah.
And that's what this is.
Yeah, I think the life thing specifically is really interesting, because something that like blew my mind when I learned it recently was that, a seed is alive. It's performing cell respiration. It's eating a little bit of its food. Its metabolism is very slow, but it's a living thing. So that speaks to me a lot with like grinding it. It, like, obviously once you smash it, it's dead, and once it's dead, it decays. So,
So
eating it as fresh as possible. And I think on the other end, not the seed end, but like on the leaf end, the same thing is true, that once you pick a plant, it starts to become autotrophic and eat itself and degrade its vitamins pretty quickly. So I think like getting people to be that close to life is sort of at the heart of both of them.
So I'm not sure if you've looked into this before with respect to flour, but one of the statistics that we came across, which was pretty mind-blowing for fresh produce, was that if it's stored in a refrigerated environment for only 1 week, it can lose between 15 and 77% of its vitamin C content.
Wow.
And, here in New York, a lot of our fresh produce, especially in the winter, is trucked up from California. It's been in the back of the truck for 5 or 6 days. It sits in the supermarket shelf for, another week. Maybe it's in your fridge for another week. So there's a huge amount of nutritional value loss through all that transport and storage.
Well, I think fortunately for fresh food, grains, as amazing as they are, don't have vitamin C, So the sailors in the old days all got scurvy because they were being fed on hard tack, and vitamin C solved that. But in fact, I'm glad you bring it up, because one of the great things is in grain, in the germ of the grain, in that life that you were talking about that's being preserved within the grain is a ton of vitamin E, which is really important for us. And even from some of the when you buy whole wheat flour at the market, a lot of that has been taken out. It's had, because if it's left in, then you don't have any shelf life on the flour.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, if you want to get the full package of vitamins, then you have to take the whole grain.
Mm-hmm.
And the wonderful thing about home milling is it gives you whole grain flour, really, truly whole grain flour, which you can't buy in a store.
This might be a crazy question, but would it ever be possible to grow your own grains at home and then mill them with the mock mill?
Yes.
That's so cool.
If we're talking possible.
It's possible, yeah.
You'd need a pretty big home, I'd say.
Yeah.
It is funny that you mentioned that, though, because I just recently read about a guy who said, I just wanted to try this out, and he just actually grew the grain in a barrel, in a plastic barrel on his patio, and talked about it. And it seems to me like a lot of work, but it is interesting. And the thing about it is that there's this incredible variety of grains. I went down to the Green Market at Union Square yesterday because I was going to be baking pancakes for somebody, and I was going to replace pastry flour with whole wheat flour. And everybody goes, whole wheat pastries, that doesn't taste any good. But I went down there. They had 14 different wheats on offer there in one shop. And so I could choose this soft white wheat that made beautiful pastry flour and made fantastic waffles. And people don't realize that you have all this choice out there. And so if you want to grow your own wheat, grow your own wheat and check into the varieties. There's a research center in Washington. They got, I'm not sure, 40,000 different kinds of wheats going. It's crazy.
Wow. Well, I'm very fascinated. I think this conversation could go on for so long. You guys all need to come back and talk more about this because I think it's just, everything you're doing is awesome. Mm-hmm. And I need Urban Leaf and a mock mill in my apartment, like ASAP.
I have just a quick question about what's next for both of you. Very short term for you, Paul. Tell us very briefly about your day tomorrow.
Oh, so tomorrow is a hugely big day. Tomorrow I'm invited for the second time in this year to visit what's recently been voted the 11th best restaurant in the world on a list of 50 best restaurants. I'm together with Wolfgang Mock, I'm the guest of Chef Don Barber at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and he's incredibly enthusiastic about fresh milling and about getting grains into the hands of the consumer. It really plays to his whole philosophy of changing the way we eat. And so that's a huge day, and I'm looking forward to it enormously. We get a tour by Rene Marion of the Stone Barns facility, which everybody should visit if they have the chance. And then we'll have that fantastic meeting with Dan Barber, who just, I'm 60. He rocks my socks.
Awesome.
It's going to be a hard one to follow.
I know. So for you guys, I want to know, first of all, how can people best find your Kickstarter and contribute and sign up to receive the world's smallest garden? And then can you give us any teasers on other products that might be coming down the pipe?
Absolutely. So you can just jump online, Google world's smallest garden. We should be one of the top results that come up. If not, then jump onto Kickstarter and search for the same. You'll definitely find us there. In terms of what's next for us, we have a bunch of interesting products and ideas that we have in our development pipeline. We've sort of put a lot of them on hold for the last little while, just while we focus on getting this thing up and running. But ultimately, yeah, we want to be developing the tools and systems and support that people need to grow their own food at home and really sort of deconsolidate the food system and make it much more local and much more personal.
Hell yeah.
And website is geturbanleaf.com?
Yep, that's it.
Got it. And mockmill. No, wolfgangmock.com.
There you go.
Nailed it.
That's mock, M-O-C-K.
Cool. All right, so we're going to wrap up the show. We always wrap up our show with trivia. So. Usually we warn people. I don't know if we did this time. I apologize.
We like to keep you on your toes.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to do it rapid fire. Okay.
Question one.
What is the oldest grain grown by man?
Einkorn.
Correct.
Nicely done, Paul.
Without hesitation.
Just like that. That's from 10,000 years ago.
Ask
from
me
the beginnings
hard.
Of farming in Mesopotamia. So Paul's got that on
Paul's
rapid
like,
recall.
That all you got? Okay, next question. How many minutes does it take to make kosher matzah?
18.
Yes. Wow.
You're killing it.
And it's been done starting from grain with a mock mill by Polly Goldman in Salinas, California this year. Hey, Polly.
All right. That's awesome. Wow. Okay. You're like probably the best at trivia we've ever had. Okay.
I swear, I don't think he can see my script.
He's not cheating.
Do you have x-ray vision, Paul?
All right. Next question. In what year was sliced bread introduced to the market?
1928.
No.
No.
21?
No.
No. 1912.
However, you were suspiciously close to the second part of the answer.
Oh.
Because
you're right.
Otto Friedrich Rochweder?
Rochweder.
This one.
W's or V?
What does it say, Paul?
Rochweder.
Rochweder.
Yeah, what he said. He introduced sliced bread in 1912, but the bakeries thought that it would go stale because we didn't have all these kind of special
additives in the day. So it didn't really catch on until 1928 when he invented a machine that would both slice and wrap the bread. So once again, Paul,
come on, give
your
me half
ability
credit.
To, yeah, you get it. You to get answer it. These trivia questions is a little bit frightening, but also very impressive and awesome.
Have you guys got any questions about basil plants?
Yeah, this is a combination of like grains and gardening questions.
All right.
Okay, so the next question is, in the Middle Ages, bread was not just a staple of the diet, but was actually used as a tool. What purpose did a piece of bread called a trencher serve?
You can also make an answer up.
What purpose did a trencher serve?
What was a trencher used for?
We're going with bread bowl over here.
Yeah, nice. I accept that. It was stale bread, about roughly 6 inches by 4 inches, and was used as an absorbent plate. So that's totally
excellent.
A bread bowl.
Congratulations.
I would normally call absorbent a fault of a plate, but it sounds like that was
not when you need it.
And then after the meal, they would give the bread to the doggies or to the poor. I guess they would decide on their priorities.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to get more into the gardening stuff. So what famous 17th century philosopher and scientist wrote the first book exploring the idea of growing plants without soil, a.k.a. hydroponics?
This is all you, Rob.
It's a fine question.
So a 17th century philosopher.
Can you tell us where he lived?
I should know that, but I don't.
I think he's British, but I'll double
check.
Yeah,
I think so, too. So he wrote it. It was published the year after his death, which was 1627.
His last name is also a food.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very delicious
tasty
food. A non-kosher food. Made out of pig.
John Hamm.
Died in 1926.
Francis Bacon.
Yes!
Very good.
There you go. All right.
But 1926, no.
1626.
Yeah.
All right, last question. So our guest today may have created the world's smallest garden, but where in the U.S. can you find the world's smallest park? This is the real challenging one.
I'll give you a hint. It's 452 square inches.
452 square inches.
And also, the name of the park is interesting, too. Because it ties into our theme.
I see what you did there.
The name of the park is Mill Ends Park. Do you know what city that might be in?
Let's go with New York.
No.
All right.
I know that we have small things in New York, like apartments and restaurant tables, but we have big parks here.
It is in the city where Bob's Red Mill is located.
So it's got to be in Portland, Oregon.
There you go.
There you go.
There you go.
Where's the ding, ding, ding? Thank
there
you.
It is.
All right.
Jeez.
So that's it for our show this week. I want to thank Beth Shapiro for calling in and telling us about City Meals, Paul LeBeau for joining us from Wolfgang Mock, and Nate Littlewood and Rob Elliott from Urban Leaf. Make sure you check all of that out. I mean, just I'm very inspired after the show.
Also, big thanks to our producers, Hallie Crane and Hannah Forden, and our fabulous engineer, David Tadashore.
Stalwart
biggest
engineer.
Biggest stalwart engineer. He's a bastion of the community.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Stalwart. Thank you.
Stalwart.
You're
a
thank
stalwart
you, Linda
bastion.
Palacio, for that accolade.
All right, so I'm Kat Johnson. This is Katie Mosen-Wadler. And stay tuned for my interview with Eli Sussman, who is the chef of Samisa. He is opening, so Jacob Riis Bazaar is back open this weekend, Memorial Day weekend, at the beach. So we're going to be talking about what to expect. Check out Samisa and Ed and Bev's at Jacob Riis Bazaar. And then make sure you go to the beach soon, because hopefully it stops raining soon and we can all enjoy some good weather.
Yeah, surf on over, dude.
Surf on over, dude. All right, that's our show. We'll
stay
see you next
tuned.
Week.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
I'm gonna
Hi, Eli. Welcome to HR and Happy Hour.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off and tell me a little bit about how you got started making and serving food at Rockaway Beach.
Sure. So we were approached by the guys that run Brooklyn Night Bazaar, which is now up in Greenpoint. And we have a camp connection to one of the founders of it. He is a Habonim guy, which my brother and I were involved in that youth group growing up. And so we got connected through that Jewish geography type of thing. And he reached out to us because we were doing pop-ups with Samisa. And he said, would you be interested in doing a beach location? So the Brooklyn Night Bazaar guys run the concession operations at Jacob Riis. So Jacob Riis is in the Rockaways, and it's by Fort Tilden, and we did it last year, and we're doing it again this year.
And it's going to be bigger and better, right?
Oh, yeah. It's we're doubling down. So last year we did there's a main bay, for those of you that have never been there. It is sort of like an indoor, half outdoor food court. There are these great roll gates that roll up. So we were in there last year, and then further down the beach, we had a standalone kiosk as well. And this year we're adding in a shipping container that's going to be a Samisa and a hot dog cart that's going to be in Ed and Bev's, which is our other concept down at the beach.
We can't get away from shipping containers.
No, they're so cool. You know, it's just, you can do so much with them. You can sit inside of them and do radio or sell hot dogs out of them.
Exactly. Yeah. So can you explain a little bit about the food of each concept?
Sure. So they're two separate concepts, and they each have their own kiosks that you can visit, basically two of each, and then a hot dog cart. So Samisa is sort of like our restaurant in Williamsburg. It's Mediterranean. So we make our own dips, and down at the beach, we're going to be doing them with vegetable chips instead of our pitas. And then we're going to be offering sort of open-faced pita sandwiches, basically. So we're going to be doing a lamb, a chicken, and a vegetarian one. And then we're going to be doing something that we like to call machos, which are going to be Mediterranean nachos, essentially.
Ooh.
So using those vegetable chips, which come in, you know, a little bag like you get at a bodega, we're going to put your choice of protein and then white sauce and green sauce over the top. So, you know, a spicy meat, crunchy bag thing. It's sort of like Frito pie. If you've ever, that's the inspiration for it. Frito pie. So it'll be like a handheld kind of trashy beach snack. And then Ed and Bev's is diner food. So it's confusing. We call it Ed and Bev's Coney Island, 'cause in Detroit, diners are called Coney Islands, and the people in the Rockaways were super confused last year. So we just call it Ed and Bev's, and essentially it's burgers, fries, cheese fries, chicken tenders, and then Coney dogs, which are hot dog with chili, mustard, and raw white onions on top.
And when do you open, and what days of the week will you be there?
Yeah, so we're going to open on Memorial Day weekend, and we're open until Labor Day. So there are some vendors that are open 7 days a week, and some are only weekend vendors. So Ed and Bev's will be open every single day. And the main bay is open every single day. And it opens at noon, and it usually closes about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Depends on the weather some days and whether there's like a special movie event or a band. But basically, you can come down and get food 7 days a week at Jacob Riis, and the bar is open 7 days a week. And then the sort of other satellite locations of our spots, as we'll call them, those are going to be weekend only. But if you come down during the week, you'll be able to get burgers and some of the other great vendors like Ample Hills will be down there with ice cream, Fletcher's Barbecue, our neighbors Bolivian Llama Party, which does some really great stuff. So full liquor and lots of food options 7 days a week. And then on the weekends, there's always music and sometimes vintage shopping, as well as lots of ice cream options up and down the beach, and then outdoor bars as well. So like on the weekends, it definitely expands and gets really robust and crazy up and down the boardwalk, but it's still nice to come there on a Tuesday and chill out. There's picnic tables and hammocks and usually either like karaoke or a live band down there.
It's awesome. That's where I was hanging out all last summer.
Yeah, it's a really amazing time. And you can be down if you want to, like, be totally by yourself. You can go down by Tilden and
it's basically deserted.
It's deserted. Yeah. And like no one is going to bother you by Tilden. And you can bring your own stuff if you want and be all the way down there. And then if you feel like grabbing some food, you can walk the 5 minutes down to Jacob Reese along the boardwalk and snag whatever drinks or food you want and then go back to kind of being like off the grid and at Tilden.
That's what I love about it. It's kind of like a choose your own adventure. You can be right there in the middle of the action at the bazaar, or you can literally walk almost all the way down the beach to the point and be on this deserted beach. It's really cool.
It's there's no other beach that I've ever visited that's simultaneously so packed with people, and the ability to find your own area is totally an option. So like you can be in the mix or you can go a couple hundred yards down the beach and no one is anywhere near you because the beach is so much more massive than other beaches. That like for people that have never been down there before, from the boardwalk to the water is several hundred yards.
It's so very wide.
It's so wide and so deep. And so it, even when it's full, it never really quote unquote fills up. Mm-hmm. There's never not space to run around and play catch. And, you know, families go down there at 8 a.m. and they set up these little kind of makeshift tent cities for themselves. Yeah. And then they hang out for 12 hours during the day and no one ever messes with each other. It's great. Yeah.
Did you go to that beach before last year much?
You know, I had been down to Tilden many times, but I have a car. So I drove, parked at Tilden, and then you kind of do this hop fence, sneaky routine type of deal. And Jacob Reese, I didn't even know that it was there with food options until we came down there on a very, very cold April day last year and looked at the food kiosk operations for the first time. I'd only been to either Tilden or then I'd gone to Rippers a bunch as well, but I'd never seen that big mile long beach area in the middle that I love it the most. I think I don't honestly know why anyone would want to go down further in the Rockaways, because they're, you know, it ends up being really, really crowded. And for me, I like a booze cocktail. And so they have these frozen cocktails at Jacob Reese that go down real easy on a 90 degree day. And there's a parking lot right there. And then a bus stops right there. Mm-hmm. And then the ferry's coming this year as well to 108. So to me, it's sort of like the best of both worlds. You got a big beach and then a lot of options to choose from.
Yeah, I would say the way that I did it last year was take the bus. It drops you off at Jacob Reese. You get drinks, get food, and then you go and you walk down the beach and you get away from the crowds. It's like really the perfect day spent in Brooklyn in the summer.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I mean, it's not even a bad bike ride. Tons of people bike down. A lot of people take the train and then bike some of the way. And then now you've got the cool ability to take the ferry from, you can take it from Greenpoint, from Williamsburg, from Sunset Park or Red Hook. I'm not 100% sure where it is over there. And so a lot of great ways to get down there to kind of experience the city. I know a lot of people that love to bike down there and kind of see a part of South Brooklyn that you don't normally spend time in. And I definitely am going to take the ferry once or twice and just see what that kind of view is. I mean, you get to hug the shoreline. I assume the views are awesome of Manhattan. They have to be incredible. So yeah, a lot of cool ways to get down there.
That's the plan. I think that like from where we are, the ferry adds maybe 10 minutes, but you get to be on a ferry and not a bus.
Yeah, it's how much more enjoyable could it be? It's like instead of saying, oh, it's such a bummer, we have to take the train down, it takes X amount of time, it's part of the day. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's do something cool and take the ferry that we wouldn't do ordinarily and make it part of sort of the adventure of getting down there.
And there are other like shuttles and private things too that you can take to get down to the beach.
Yeah, there's also a bar Pearls runs mm-hmm. a bus, so you can go drink at Pearls and then take a bus down to that beach. And you know, taking the train down to the bus is still pretty easy if that's the way you want to get down there. Mm-hmm. And then you're rewarded with, you know, 20 food options and, you know, a lot of awesome activities up and down the boardwalk.
Maybe Simesa needs to have a shuttle between locations.
Oh God, that would be incredible. We could take people from our 10-seat restaurant yeah. to our 100,000 capacity beach in our Simesa.
Just 10 at a time.
Yeah, exactly. Just I'll throw them in the back of my Junker Prius and
there you go.
Have them like hold some cucumber lemonade on their lap, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. Be like, you get to eat for free if you help me load up my car with all the pita and stuff.
That sounds like a deal.
Yeah, it's actually like, I should probably look into that, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Eli. I cannot wait for the summer. I can't wait for Memorial Day so we can go eat lots of good food and get tan.
See you down there.
Cool.
Yeah, come on down.
All right.
Surf on over, dude.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.